Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Rituparna, and today I'm going to be in conversation with Ashok Gopal. Ashok Gopal is a graduate in history from the Savitribai Phule Pune University. After working as a journalist for 15 years in Mumbai and Pune, he has worked as a freelance content writer for some years and then shifted to the development sector. Since the year 2000, he has worked as a consultant for a number of NGOs, including grassroots organizations in the Bundelkhand region of Uttar Pradesh, India. He has supported NGOs in the areas of proposal development, monitoring and documentation in the domains of natural resource management, livelihood development, rights and entitlements, and rural education. He has also developed the curriculum and multilingual resource materials for activity-based teaching and learning of competencies related to constitutional values in primary schools. As an independent researcher, he has been studying the life and thoughts of Dr. B.R. Ambedkar since 2003. The output of his effort is a part apart, The Life and Thought of B.R. Ambedkar, an intellectual biography of Dr. B.R. Ambedkar. It draws on a number of English and Marathi sources and provides a wealth of material previously unavailable in English. It is this book that we will be discussing in today's podcast. Ashok, I welcome you to this conversation and look forward to discussing the book.
Thank you.
So let me begin by asking you about your main motivation behind writing a book on Ambedkar. What was it?
Well, initially, my motivation, I didn't start with the intention of writing a book. I was just studying Ambedkar's thought. After a few years, I realized that there are a lot of gaps and inadequacies in what has been written about Dr. Ambedkar. So those had to be filled. So that was my motivation. Then subsequently, after the first draft of the book was done, the publisher, who was also my editor, suggested that, you know, more biographical information should be added and all that. So the scope of the book widened. And then I had also the objective that I should write in a manner that, you know, even a lay person can understand Dr. Ambedkar's life and thought. So to reach to the maximum audience, that was my an objective that developed after the first draft.
Right. So what are some of the methods and sources that you have used in bringing Ambedkar's life to the limelight?
Yeah. So there are two parts. One is about his life, and then the other is about his evolution of his thought. As far as his life is concerned, there is a biography, multi-volume biography available in Marathi, which is can be treated as a primary source because the author knew Dr. Ambedkar and was associated him for some time. And so that is actually the only sort of primary source we have on many aspects of Ambedkar's early life, especially. And then, of course, there are other materials. A lot of Dalit archivists have found out information about his family and about his activity. So that all that material was what I used for as far as about his life is concerned. As far as his ideas are concerned, I used all his writings and speeches in Marathi and in English. Initially, till the 30s, he wrote a lot in Marathi. After that, it was mostly in English only. So I basically went through the entire writing and speeches of Dr. Ambedkar, including some which have not been featured in the government publication on Dr. Ambedkar's writing and speeches. There are some omissions. So including those, I studied all of them repeatedly to find the common trends and recurring ideas, recurring concerns.
Right. So could you also talk about your own positionality as a researcher and author?
So, as I said, I wanted to communicate Dr. Ambedkar's life and thought to the largest possible audience. So my experience as a journalist and as an education content developer, of course, came into play there. But apart from that, there is a position that it's an unavoidable position, that is your social background. So that is something, I say it upfront that I come from a upper caste family, and I have not experienced any of those deprivations and humiliations that Dalits have experienced routinely. So this position of privilege is something that has to be acknowledged, and one has to see that is that clouding your views, or are you not saying something that you ought to be saying? So therefore, in the entire writing process, the reviews by a certain eminent scholars was important, including Dalit scholars. So on the basis of their feedback and all that, I developed the final manuscript. I have lived with Dr. Ambedkar's thought for a long time. So if there were no major kind of flaws in my manuscript, but still there were things that were pointed out and I had to address.
Okay, interesting. So do you think that reading Ambedkar also challenged your own preconceived ideas and assumptions?
Yeah, so to start with, before I started reading Dr. Ambedkar, I had read a lot about and by Mahatma Gandhi and also Jawaharlal Nehru. So, and I did have a certain view of Mahatma Gandhi. But of course, that was one of the first things that reading Ambedkar, I realized that, there is, the Mahatma was also he also had his failings. So that was one of the first realizations. Later, I also realized something that Dr. Ambedkar points out, that Indian scholarship has been highly class-based, so to speak. He used class and caste in overlapping ways. So there are certain things that scholars have not even studied. Like at the time he wrote about untouchability, about the origin of untouchability, he said that, this is an issue that nobody has even tackled. One can understand that foreign scholars are not tackling it, but Indian scholars are... till that time, no one had even addressed that issue. So this is a chronic problem in Indian scholarship. It's what he called its class bias. So these are some of the things I realized. And when I look back at my own education and the kind of education I had received, basically, I had studied history and constitutional history of India, but I had hardly come across Dr. Ambedkar in my college education. So that itself shows the kind of biases that exist, deep biases that exist in our curriculum. So these are some of the things that were quite eye-opening to me. And of course, later there are other ideas on these ideas on democracy and all that. But those were like learning, but there were the points I mentioned earlier are about unlearning. So there was quite a bit of unlearning that I had to do.
Right. Also, you know, you very interestingly mentioned that Ambedkar was not a thinker in the traditional sense. Why do you think this is the case?
So he was a thinker in politics. He was a thinker in public life. So, and his thought emerged out of the conditions he faced, the opportunities that were available, and the other people involved, the other political interests involved, including the British government and the Congress and all that. So his thought is a very live kind of response to actual situations. So that way, he's nowhere an armchair thinker or philosopher. That's one of the basic key features of his thought. And at the same time, while there, it is not just that he's just responding to situations. He's following certain principles and he's following certain methods. So that principles and methods are applicable, can be applied even today. The particular ideas that he mooted or the strategies he followed at that time may not be relevant, but the principles and method are relevant even today. So in this sense, he is very different from your philosopher who is sitting in an isolated zone and talking about some universal truths and things like that. So his thought is very dynamic and it has to be understood that way. So that I thought is a very major difference between him and the traditional notion of a thinker or a philosopher in India.
All right. So how did Ambedkar manage to be both a social reformist and a statesman at the same time?
Whether he managed to do it successfully is open to debate, because I mean, social reformist, a political leader and statesman. Because his struggle was that while he was representing a highly marginalized group of people in India, and he was struggling to establish their basic human rights, he also had the larger, the whole society in mind, and he wanted to play a role in nation building also. So this was a difficult kind of dualism that he tried to deal with. So sometimes he switched more to one side than the other, particularly when the Constitution of India was being drafted. He took certain stands which were against his own earlier stands. So it is a difficult path he followed, and it could be argued that he probably was not as successful in managing it as he would have liked. So that is one of the many aspects of his work, which is where we have to make our own judgments. Yeah.
Well, to ask you yet another very difficult question and also a broad one, what did Ambedkar think about democracy?
Yeah, so his notion of democracy was fundamentally different from the what we understand as democracy in school and what is generally understood. That is, we have the idea of basically representative government and which assures certain basic freedoms to all citizens. Now, so it's a political, we are talking of political structures and institutions. But Ambedkar's view, which was to a great extent influenced by the views of the American philosopher John Dewey, who was his teacher in Columbia University, their democracy is very much a way of life, a form of society, where the interactions between people are so rich and different people and different groups are so rich that everybody learns and everybody develops, everybody's personality develops through this process. So it is, and he called that social democracy. He did not use that term. Dr. Ambedkar used that term, and he made a fundamental difference between social democracy and political democracy and said that what we got after independence, I mean, through the constitution of India, is political democracy. But social democracy has yet to be created in this country. That is to say, the kind of conditions that will allow for a free exchange of views and experiences across social groups and different interests. So it is you could say there is something utopian in that vision, but it is based on solid social psychology. That is to say that, you know, we learn through our interactions with others. That is the basic thing. People who have limited interactions with others are relatively underdeveloped as compared to, in terms of their personalities, as compared to people who have a wide range of different interactions with different kinds of people. So that was the notion of democracy that he had. And that kind of interaction, of course, requires, you require liberty, you require equality, and you have to have a very strong sense of fraternity, that all of us are all said and done for. With all our differences, we are part of one big human family. So that that moral value of fraternity is the base of social democracy.
Yeah, I mean, of course, right. So what were his ideas on caste? How did he think about caste through a constitutional lens?
So on the constitutional lens is a different aspect. As far as caste is concerned, he recognized that it was a major determinant of opportunities and interactions and status and living conditions in India. So that he highlighted that probably more than anybody else in his time. He also identified some of the features of caste, like, for example, caste works through endogamy, which still is the case even today. He also identified that caste is a system of, it's a system of what he called graded inequality. That is to say that every caste looks down upon some other caste. So it's like a ladder where every caste is got some, has the privilege, you could say, a negative privilege of looking down upon somebody else. And finally, the last at the bottom of the ladder is, of course, the untouchables, who are shunned by all the people above. So these were his ideas on caste, in essence. As far as when it came to the constitution of India was concerned, there was the caste is not mentioned in the constitution. Untouchability is abolished, but caste itself is not abolished. So that, and it was not part of his demands also. So that is there was a technical and legal issue there, because by then reservations based on for reservations for scheduled caste was accepted, and also it was accepted that certain benefits should be offered to what are today known as OBCs. So if this system has to work, then you can't say that the caste is not there. So it's a paradox, you know. For getting over the discrimination enforced by caste, one has to recognize the existence of caste. So therefore, the Constitution of India is silent on caste.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So when we are talking about class, there is also a difference in the way Ambedkar looks at caste and class from other Indian thinkers. And of course, we have to talk about his ideological relationship with M.K. Gandhi, the name that you also mentioned at the beginning itself. So how do you see his analysis of the issues of caste and class as different and his relationship with Gandhi?
Yeah. So caste and, so there, as far as caste and versus class was concerned, he was pitted against the communists who recognized the, at this time at least, in his time at least, only class as the main vehicle of the social and economic relations in India or anywhere in the world. And he kept saying that, you know, you cannot ignore caste. Class matters, of course, but caste also matters. And in fact, caste comes before class because he analyzed this very well. He said at one place that, you know, both when it depending on the situation, people foreground their caste or class identity. So, but the caste identity remains; it is permanent. Class identity can change depending on your, you know, economic circumstances. You could be an owner of a factory one day, and tomorrow you may be on the streets. But your caste identity will not go, irrespective of your whatever happens in your life. You will continue to enjoy its privilege or suffer its disadvantages. So that was his, one of his fundamental disagreements with communist, Marxist, socialist, Sapist. As far as Gandhi was concerned, it is a bit complicated because prima facie Gandhi was against caste, but at the same time he wanted to, for a large part of his life, he upheld the Chaturvarna model, and he put it across as some kind of an ideal society model. And Ambedkar's very firm opinion was that if you want to dump caste, you have to dump Chaturvarna. Chaturvarna is the ideological base of caste. And so therefore, what Gandhi was saying is that, you know, we'll do away with caste, but we'll retain Chaturvarna. To Dr. Ambedkar, that just didn't make sense at all. So, of course, in later in life, it appears that Gandhi changed his views on Chaturvarna, but those are like stray comments, and you don't get a full rejection. At least I couldn't see a kind of a complete rejection of Chaturvarna ideology, and Dr. Ambedkar certainly could not.
Right. In your book, of course, 1930 also comes up. So what role does this year play in shaping Ambedkar's ideas?
It was a very important year in two ways. One was that was the time when there was an opportunity available through the Simon Commission and the first round table conference. An opportunity was available for the depressed classes, as they were known then, to strongly argue their case for assured political representation. This opportunity was available earlier in 1919 also, but that was a very limited opportunity which Dr. Ambedkar used and could not obtain much. So, and after 10 years, that opportunity was to come, saying 29, it did come. So that was a very important turning point for him. And at that time, he had to emerge as a national spokesman for a depressed class. So it was a big step that he had to take. Simultaneously, it was also a time when Just in that day, I think Satyagraha had started in Nashik by his supporters for entry into a Ram temple there. And that was a very sustained agitation. So that was actually the largest instance of mass mobilization of the depressed classes till then. So both things were happening. He was concerned about what was happening in Nashik. At the same time, he was concerned about what he could obtain from in London. So 1930 is actually the time he emerges as a national leader, you could say.
Right. So, what were his views on religion and Buddhism?
On religion, he took religion seriously. He took religion very seriously, and he thought that religion had a great influence on people's lives, and religion could not be just dismissed as opium of the masses or whatever. And at the same time, he was not ready to accept religion as a given, which you have to just take, whatever you have got from your ancestors, whatever religion you have got, and whatever practices and customs they have been following, you just continue that tradition. He was not ready to accept that. He wanted religion to be examined like anything else, like any other aspect of human life or human experience. And he wanted a religion based on reason, I mean, at least aligned to rationality, conducive to democracy, upholding human dignity. So he, and these were not necessarily values that were prominent at the time when the ancient religions evolved. So you could say that he would have been better off with a modern religion, but he was not interested in starting some kind of religious movement or something. He wanted to build on existing traditions, and for that he found Buddhism the most suitable for his purposes. So accordingly, he interpreted, he gave a interpretation of Buddhism that is, it was not entirely unique, because there were people before him who also saw Buddhism as a rational social ethic, which is conducive to which is aligned to modern values. But nevertheless, that his the how the how he related religion to social democracy, Buddhism to social democracy, that was very unique. So he is a thinker on religion. And also another thing is that he was not just interested in a sort of an intellectual acceptance of a religion. He had that thing that it is about a certain faith, and so there is a so it's again it's complicated. So there is a intellectual acceptance, but at the same time, the religious experience also mattered to him. So therefore, he had idols of Buddha, and he was not he didn't believe in idol worship, but still that treating some places and objects and some ideas as sacred and inviolable, as we do in as is normal in other religions, was also important for him. So he was trying to forge a new way of looking at religion, which does not entirely reject what we have received from the past, but at the same time does not entirely accept the past also, whatever we have got from the past. So it is a challenging interpretation for us even today.
Okay, so do you feel that there are any limitations in your work or like some challenges that you face?
So there are some obvious limitations, because it is a book on Dr. Ambedkar's and on the evolution of his idea. So certain aspects of his life, for example, his work as a lawyer, that's not covered. That was the source of his livelihood. That was not covered much, hardly covered, in fact. Then his associates and contemporaries are just dealt with as you know, you could say in the language of fiction, they are side characters. So, you know, I have not gone into detail there. So, and even the like the political struggles of the Scheduled Caste Federation, which were conducted independently of Dr. Ambedkar, that again I have not gone into. So, because my focus is on Dr. Ambedkar, so a lot of things around that was happening around him and was relevant at that time, that has been sort of downplayed or excluded. That was one. Secondly, as far as within the scope, within the frame of the book, there were certain unavoidable limitations. One is that, you know, I am trying to communicate in a manner that a lay person can understand. So I have to go at a certain pace, but still the number of ideas is so much. So what happened? And then there are limits to a size of a book, a printed book. So many ideas I have not gone into as much detail as some other authors might go into. So that was one. Then on certain, given the on the limitations of sources available, there are some aspects of Ambedkar's life related to the evolution of his thought about which we don't know much at all. Like, for example, he decided to form the Independent Labour Party in the mid-30s. It comes as almost like a sudden announcement. You know, he would have certainly talked about this with his colleagues, but we don't have any record of those conversations. So there are these kind of gaps in his when we try to understand the different stages in his thought. So some limitations are imposed by the frame of the book. Some limitations are imposed by the audience I was trying to address, and some limitations are because of the paucity of sources. And there could be some other limitations which critics will note in their
So last question: why do you think that, you know, a book on Ambedkar is necessary? What is the global and national need for it? In other words, who should be reading Ambedkar and why?
Yeah, so my not so humble belief is that every educated person should read Dr. Ambedkar. Everybody who values human dignity and democracy should read Ambedkar, Dr. Ambedkar. Everybody who is socially sensitive, aware, and wants to play a meaningful role in society, wants to lead what Dr. Ambedkar would consider a good life. That is that you don't just take care of yourselves, but you also work for the larger good as much as you can within your limitations and your position. So all such people of course, a basic education is assumed, because to understand Dr. Ambedkar, you will need to have familiarity with some of the concepts that he is using. So I would say at least a basic school education is required. So given that, with these givens, everybody should read Dr. Ambedkar. Although, there is a principles he follows and methods of thinking. These remain valid and useful even today, although particular strategies he adopted or particular theories he put forward may not be valid today. And of course, conditions in his time and conditions in our time are greatly changed. So even, for example, the influence of caste in his time was different from the influence of caste today. Caste works in a different manner, some things remain, what he pointed out remain, like endogamy remains the main characteristics of low feature of caste. Caste works through endogamy. Arranged marriages are based on endogamy. But there are some other aspects of caste, and like how caste is used in politics, how caste networks work, and how caste is now, you know, there's a resurgence also of caste identity, more than, in some cases, more than it was in his time. In his time, all said and done, the nationalist movement also wanted to was saying that, you know, caste is something we have to get over. But today, in some pockets, in some areas, we see that people are flaunting that their caste as if it's a... So they are not ashamed of caste. They are not saying that this is something that we have to get over. So situations have changed. So therefore, we have to understand the situation also. But the principles he followed, the values he upheld, and the methods he followed remain very useful. Apart from that, of course, his life struggle itself is a great source of inspiration. And other things, you know, his reading and how he formed ideas and all that. There is so much to learn from him.
Yeah. Okay. So thank you so much for this conversation. And I truly enjoyed talking to you about your new book. And like you said, I hope each and every person picks up a copy and reads Ambedkar for what he has to offer to this world. Thank you once again, Ashok, for joining me on New Books Network and for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you. Thank you very much.